A new report by the American Association of University Professors blasts the Iowa Board of Regents for the way it hired the new UI president. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The damning report says the Regents did a disservice to the people of Iowa by hiring Bruce Harreld. We'll hear from a member of the investigating committee. Also this hour, why the state's health care providers are hesitating to sign on to new managed care plans, an update on the controversial Bakken pipeline, the family leader endorses Ted Cruz, and we'll talk with an Iowa high school cross-country runner who was disqualified after helping another runner in need. Buckle up for your News Buzz. First, this news from NPR. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This week, the American Association of University Professors released a blistering report concluding that the process the Iowa Board of Regents used while considering whether to hire Bruce Harreld as the new president of the University of Iowa gave, in the words of the report, only an illusion of an open, honest search. Michael DeCesar is chair of the Committee on College and University Governance for the American Association of University Professors and a professor of sociology at Merrimack College. He visited Iowa back in October as part of the investigation. He joins me now by phone. Professor DeCesar, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ben. It's good to be with you.
The report lays out the history of this selection process and says one possible interpretation is that the search was fair, but the selection of Harreld by the board was not, because the Regents ignored deep faculty opposition to Harreld's candidacy. However, this report that you were involved in, the authors say they reject that conclusion. What is the conclusion that is reached instead?
That the search from the beginning was foreordained to produce a particular candidate, Ben. And that candidate would be somebody who came from the world of business and offered some kind of vision of transformative leadership, somebody who would come to the university and change it into something. What that something was, we weren't able to determine.
Mm-hmm. So in other words, the selection process was a charade.
According to our investigation, yes. Based on what we heard from the people we interviewed and all the information and documents we collected, yes, it was a sham.
Mm-hmm. Give us some of the evidence. How did you reach this conclusion?
Well, some of it came in right before we went out to Iowa. Some of it came in afterward. Some of the evidence included the fact that the eventual appointee, Mr. Harreld, was given treatment that the other three finalists were not given. For example, he was set up with a private phone conversation with the governor before he was even an official candidate for the position. He was invited to campus early in July and to give a talk and had lunch with four members of the search committee at that time. Just 3 weeks later, toward the end of July, he met with four members of the Board of Regents. He also had dinner during that visit with the president of Iowa State, Stephen Leaf. So all of this started to add up, and what we saw emerge very clearly was that Mr. Harreld, at least from July and maybe even earlier, was somebody who had been tagged by members of the search committee as somebody who could ultimately become the president.
Mm-hmm. How uncommon is this when we select a university president of the caliber of the University of Iowa? Does this happen?
Uncommon in terms of Mr. Harreld's qualifications?
Well, I guess qualifications would be one, but that as you say, the selection process was a sham and that it was preordained who the appointee would be.
Well, it's not clear at this point how common it is, Ben, but it does seem to be more common now than ever before. We've seen contested presidential searches at several universities just since this summer, including the one at Iowa, of course. And what's emerged as a similarity among all of them is this emphasis among certain members of the search committee, usually members of the governing board, who want somebody from the world of business, somebody who's not a traditional academic leader, somebody who can come in and apply kind of corporate business principles to the operation of a university or college.
Your report came to the conclusion that this search was a disservice to Iowans, only an illusion of an open and honest search. Why does that matter in this context? What damage has been done in view of your association?
Well, it matters, I think, to the citizens of Iowa. I mean, ultimately, the governing board of an institution of higher education is responsible to the citizens of the state. When it acts in such a fashion, and by that I mean really disregarding the opinions of the faculty, for example, and other campus constituencies, then that is detrimental to the citizenry that it serves.
Mm-hmm. What does the report recommend at this point?
Well, what we recommended primarily was that everybody, including the faculty, give it time and see whether Mr. Harold lives up to the promises that he has made consistently since he's been appointed, namely that he's going to respect shared governance on campus. He's going to work with the faculty. He's going to listen. He's acknowledged that he has a steep learning curve, and he says he'll rely on the faculty's advice in trying to climb that curve. And so what we recommended was that the faculty take him at his word at that, while they also stay vigilant.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the faculty, the ones who are most vehemently opposed to his hiring, are being fair, have been fair? Did you find that out in your investigation, your visit to Iowa City?
All the evidence indicates that, yeah, that they were fair. It's important to remember that the vote of no confidence in the Board of Regents was taken by the Faculty Senate, which is a body composed of 80 or 90 faculty from across campus. They're a representative body. So this wasn't some small, unelected, unrepresentative group of disgruntled faculty. This was the formal governing body of the faculty.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, is there anything in the report to the effect that this may be looked on years down the road, should the University of Iowa or any other public universities in Iowa need a new president? And I guess a candidate would be wondering, am I here for show, according to your report, or am I here for real?
We do make reference to exactly that sentiment in the report. We say that it's difficult to imagine anyone of any intelligence, that's the language we use, who would want to put his or her name in the ring for the presidency of a university that engages in a process like the one we just saw. One other thing I would point out, Ben, is that this isn't the first time a search like this has taken place. The faculty voted no confidence in the board back in 2006 as well. I think the final vote was 62-1 over the failed presidential search that took place that year. Some of this, we saw some of the same things happen this time around, but this one was also significantly different.
Mm-hmm. President Harold is now in office. Your organization, the Association, American Association of University Professors, has no authority over the Iowa Board of Regents. Will there be any sanctions, or are you in a position to have any sanctions?
It's hard to say whether they will be at this point. We do have a process by which an institution can be sanctioned by the association itself. That happens. That could happen at the association's annual meeting, which takes place every summer. In the June 2016 meeting, it remains to be seen whether a sanction vote will be recommended to that body. The Committee on College and University Governance is the body that would recommend a sanction vote to the annual meeting if it came to that.
You have no feeling, sense of either way whether that would be voted for?
I do not, not at this point.
During your investigation, you came to Iowa City to do interviews, as you said. Did you speak to get the other side's view? Did you speak with any of the Board of Regents members, with the president, Bruce Rastetter?
We invited President Rastetter to speak with us. We invited the interim president of the university, President Robillard, to speak with us. Both of them declined. They cited pending litigation. We invited Mr. Harold to speak with us. He did not respond at that time. So in terms of if that's what you mean by the other side, then no, they just didn't give us the opportunity to speak with them. We did follow up with them to ask a second time. We were rebuffed that time as well. We did note with pleasure and with a, you know, with a feeling of encouragement that Mr. Harold's response to our report was positive. He agreed with our findings that the process worked the way we claimed that it did.
Mm-hmm. As a matter of coincidence or fact, next Tuesday, the president of the Iowa Board of Regents, Bruce Rastetter, is scheduled to be my guest on this program next Tuesday. I wonder, in closing, if you had a question, since you had no access to Bruce Rastetter, any of the Board of Regents, if you had a question or a message you would most like to communicate to him.
I think the message, not a question, but the message that I would communicate to him is that this is an important time in the history of the University of Iowa. There's a clear disconnect between the faculty and the board. Regardless of who was appointed president, regardless of Mr. Harold himself, there's a clear disconnect between the faculty and the board. And I would encourage Mr. Rastetter in the strongest possible terms to reach out to the faculty. The faculty has made several efforts to extend an olive branch to the board, and they've been rebuffed. I would encourage him to try to reciprocate.
Okay, thank you very much for your time. Michael DeCesar is chair of the Committee on College and University Governance for the American Association of University Professors, professor of sociology at Merrimack College. American Association of University Professors released this week a blistering report concluding that the process that the Iowa Board of Regents used to consider whether to hire Bruce Harold as the new president of the University of Iowa gave, in the words of the report, only an illusion of an open and honest search. Michael DeCesar, welcome, or thank you very much.
Thank you, Ben. It was a pleasure.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Healthcare providers across the state are showing hesitancy to sign on to new managed care plans that will replace the state-run Medicaid program. They're saying that this timeline on which the state is expecting Iowans to receive care through the program doesn't allow enough time to choose a new healthcare plan, and that healthcare providers don't have enough time to sort through the details. Greg Bodenhammer is with us, Senior Vice President of Government Relations for the Iowa Hospital Association. He joins me now. Greg, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Ben.
The Iowa Association, Hospital Association opposes this move altogether, so much so that your association has filed a suit to stop the implementation of these managed care plans. Tell us why.
Well, several reasons, Ben. First of all, we believe that Iowa was already on a path to achieve the same kind of savings that the governor thinks that managed care will bring to our state. Since the creation of the Iowa Health and Wellness Plan 2 years ago, hospitals, the state of Iowa, and even the federal government have invested very heavily in the creation of what are called accountable care organizations, or health homes, to better manage the care of the Medicaid population. These ACOs have demonstrated track record of success today, where people are getting their physicals, they're getting their health risk assessments, and the quality of care is actually improving, at the same time achieving cost savings. So we believe that we need to return to the path that Iowa has already been on, that Medicaid managed care has not worked in other states where it's been implemented. And in fact, our litigation that's seeking a delay points to conflicts in state and federal law in terms of how the plan was financed.
What are the biggest problems with the plan, the current quick transition to these managed care plans?
Well, I think that we all have to understand that when you're talking about contracts, we're dealing with billions of dollars. There's $4.2 billion in the Medicaid program. That takes a lot of time for folks to work through. Additionally, from a provider perspective, there's been a lack of detail around a lot of the main contracting points you would consider, like what exactly are your reimbursement rates, or how is that going to be calculated for a critical access hospital, and at the same time then moving the administrative pieces away from a single payer to four separate insurance companies who all have their own methodologies when it comes to claims administration and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. So give us a sense of care providers that are not willing to be on board yet here. Are there enough providers that I suppose, if this lawsuit fails and if the state sticks to its timeline, can the providers who are on board at this point provide care to all of the Medicaid recipients in the state?
No, I would suggest not. I mean, I think the first thing we have to keep in mind is, first and foremost, the federal government hasn't even blessed this policy, this plan yet. So until that happens, it really is, you know, we're doing a lot of planning and a lot of implementation from the administration's perspective, but the federal government has to determine that there's network adequacy. In the Medicaid program, we have to provide beneficiaries with choice. So even though there's been a lot of news releases about the providers who have signed contracts, it's, when you think about four companies in a statewide network, it's a fairly limited number of providers who have signed on to date. That creates real challenges for trying to demonstrate there's a statewide network. Medicaid's definition of an appropriate network means you have to be able to be within 30 minutes or 30 miles of all the different necessary providers that Medicaid covers.
Mm-hmm. Other than the quick timeline here, are there reasons why providers, other reasons why providers are hesitant? For instance, we've heard reports of corruption from within the companies who are going to be taking over the program.
Yeah, I think it's less to do with the specifics of the companies themselves, but just an understanding of what managed care has done in other states. We're taking, again, a $4.2 billion program. We're suggesting we're going to save $100 million, and we're going to turn about $500 million over to these companies. So that means we're taking $600 million out of a program and claiming that we're going to provide the same services to the same number of beneficiaries and pay providers the same rates. That math doesn't work. And what we've seen in other states is that the MCOs, the managed care organizations, turn to things like reduced provider reimbursement or denial of care for people who really need those services, because that's the only way they can make money at the end of the day.
Okay. Greg Botenhammer, thank you very much. Senior Vice President of Government Relations for the Iowa Hospital Association. We appreciate your time, Greg.
Anytime, Ben.
A NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Quickly before we come up to our break, the company looking to build the Dakota Access Pipeline. This is the pipeline that would carry crude oil from the Bakken oil fields in North Dakota to Illinois. Is urging the Iowa Utilities Board to hurry up making their decision about whether to grant the company a permit to build, as well as eminent domain powers for landowners who have yet to sign on. The pipeline would carry over 500,000 barrels of oil a day through a 30-inch pipe that would stretch 346 miles across 18 Iowa counties. Brian Morelli is with us of the Cedar Rapids Gazette. He's been following this story, and he joins us. Hi, Brian.
Hi, how's it going?
Fine. So the Dakota Access Pipeline people want this to be hurried up. Why?
Well, they earlier this year, the Utilities Board had put out a kind of a tentative timeline of December or early January for a decision, which lined up with what Dakota Access had been hoping for in terms of getting construction started. They wanted to begin building the pipeline in the beginning of 2016 and have it operational by the end of 2016.
Mm-hmm. So correct me if I'm wrong, but there's only been one public hearing on this pipeline held on November 12th in Boone. What is going on now that I guess we won't get a decision from the Iowa Utilities Board until February? Why will it take until then?
Well, so a couple things. One is they called a hearing, but actually it stretched for several days. The public comment period was on the 12th, but then they had an evidentiary hearing with all the, I think there was a, you know, 80 or 100 witnesses that were scheduled between the 16th, and it actually the hearing just wrapped up on Monday night, I think around 10 p.m. So the hearing went a lot longer, and I think there was more witnesses and what they call interveners, which are interested parties in the case, than maybe they had anticipated when they suggested they might have it wrapped up by December or January several months ago. So what happens now, they have to finalize the transcript of the case, and after they do that, there's a briefing period where the parties can file post-hearing briefs and then reply to the post-hearing briefs, and they're still deciding what the deadline is for that period. The Dakota Access Group had suggested having that wrapped up by January 22nd, I believe, and some of the landowners are pushing for February 1st. So, and then after that point, then the utilities board, or kind of during this time, the utilities board is also reviewing all of the testimony, all the exhibits, and comparing it against state law, comparing it to past cases. And my understanding is there's like some 7,000 pages mm-hmm. worth of documents they need to go through.
Got a couple,
they make a decision.
Brian, a couple minutes left, but is eminent domain really at the heart of this, the dispute over that? Some landowners not wanting to have that oil pipeline underneath their land?
In Iowa, it's a really big deal because it's two separate, it's kind of part of the same hearing, but it's two separate decisions. So the utilities board could say yes to the pipeline, but then, you know, limit eminent domain, which would make things a little bit more complicated for Dakota Access.
Mm-hmm.
But it runs, it's different in different states. So, for example, South Dakota, I mean, there's a lot of hurdles left for this pipeline. You know, it's going through North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, and Illinois. South Dakota is the only state that's approved it already. And part of their approval automatically grants eminent domain.
Now, Dakota Access, I understand, is a Texas-based company, but it's already purchased pipe and stacked it near Newton. You've been to see the pipe.
Yeah, we went on a little scavenger hunt through rural Iowa several weeks ago. And I mean,
where's Waldo, kind of, huh? Where are the pipes?
Really, it was kind of interesting. You know, we were kind of driving for a couple hours and, you know, is it really going to be there? And then, you know, we're driving down this dirt road, and sure enough, there's, I mean, it's just mounds and mounds of this 30-inch diameter pipe. They must have been, you know, 50 feet long, and they just stacked as far, I mean, I don't want to say as far as the eye could see, but it was just, there's a lot of them there. We kind of did a rough estimate that there was probably enough to cover the 350 miles of pipe that will be laid across Iowa.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. Must give you a sense of asking the question as a reporter. Is this a done deal? Is there a reason to believe that it's been actually decided unofficially if they're this far into, well, getting all that pipe into Iowa?
Well, some people think that's the case. I mean, the utilities board, I mean, clearly from their timeline, they're saying we're going to give this a fair shake. We're looking at it. We haven't made up our minds yet. You know, some people also think that some of that is posturing on the part of Dakota Access, just, you know, kind of giving the impression that it's a done deal, you know, both to put maybe some pressure on the utilities board, but also landowners, you know, when they're negotiating these easements for, you know, to run the pipe through their property. If, you know, if the landowners think, hey, this is a done deal, you know, we're not going to get a better deal than the deal you're offering us now, maybe, you know, maybe they go ahead and sign. I think that's the sense some people have.
Okay, Brian Morelli, we'll keep our eye on this story. Thank you for helping us out today. Brian Morelli of the Cedar Rapids Gazette.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to take a short break and be back with more of our News Buzz edition of River to River. Kedron Bardwell will be with us, a political scientist at Simpson College. We'll talk about the family leader, that's Bob Vanderplaat's organization, the Christian conservative organization here in Iowa, endorsed Ted Cruz this week. Powerful endorsement. We'll ask Kedron what that could mean. Also, we'll talk with an Iowa high school cross-country runner, an 18-year-old who was disqualified. You'll love to hear this story. It's very moving. He was disqualified after winning the race because he went back and helped another runner in need. We'll find out about that story when we return. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in just a few minutes.
Support.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The past few weeks have been very good to Ted Cruz here in Iowa. He's rising in the polls. He's building on an already extensive field organization, and he's locking down critical conservative endorsements. The biggest endorsement for him yet came yesterday when Bob Vanderplaat, he's head of the conservative group Family Leader based here in Iowa, that group came out for Cruz yesterday. Vanderplaat cited what he sees as Cruz's electability in our state and nationally. Kedron Bardwell joins us, Associate Professor of Political Science and Department Chair at Simpson College. Welcome back to the program, Kedron.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
So why did Bob Vanderplaat choose Cruz over the other top-tier candidates, Trump, Rubio, Carson?
Well, if you look at what he talked about in his endorsement speech, he talked about the fact that Cruz has just a consistent, very conservative record. He also mentioned just his ability to raise money, which is important. If you want to be in this for the long haul and not just win Iowa but win other states, you need to have the financial backing to continue, which some of the conservative candidates of the Iowa caucuses in the past have not been able to pull together. He also mentioned that Cruz has captured some of the outsider feeling that Trump and Carson have been taking advantage of, and has portrayed himself effectively as someone who is a Senate insider but also has been on the outside of the establishment in the Republican Party and has challenged them when need be. So I think Ted Cruz is someone who Vanderplaat sees as authentically conservative, also authentically conservative Christian, and someone who he thinks can win.
I'm sure Bob Vanderplaat's had an eye on the polls. What about Cruz's popularity among Iowa's evangelicals? Are there polls out that indicate it matches up with this choice?
Well, if you look at the polls just before this, Rubio and Cruz had made a few moves in terms of some positive movement, and you had seen Carson start to decline. And so it was right for Cruz to build on the momentum that he started with from the Steve King endorsement and some other endorsements that he's picked up among Christian conservatives. And Vanderplaat is certainly, I think, the most well-known Christian conservative leader in the state after the gay marriage fight and some other issues that he's been involved with. So it was really kind of a perfect alignment to get this trifecta of endorsements from Steve King and Steve Deese and now Bob Vanderplaat. And really at the right time, I think conservatives have been worried that they would coalesce too late, as happened with Santorum last time around. This time they're definitely coalescing early enough. I guess the question would be how Cruz then holds on with the increasing expectations that will be on him now.
Mm-hmm. You referenced Rick Santorum. It was Rick Santorum who was endorsed by Bob Vanderplaat in 2012.
Yep.
and came up memorably as the winner, but that was only declared a few days after the actual day of the caucuses, or the day after, and so he didn't really enjoy the media splash that one would expect going into the other primary states. How important is this endorsement? Also in practical terms, we know that it gets out there in the media following politics, but in practical terms, what can Bob Vanderplaat and family leader do for Cruz?
Well, I think you talk about mobilization. They just have the connections and the networks with especially the activists in Iowa in order to turn out the vote. Now, you have to kind of think about evangelicalism more broadly and then look at the Iowa picture. More broadly, if you look nationally, evangelicals are actually divided into about three camps. There's a more moderate evangelical wing, which is made up of a number of the younger generation evangelical voters. There's mainstream evangelicals, represented by the National Association of Evangelicals, and Russell Moore, Baptist leader, is one of the prominent voices. In that large group, he's been outspoken in his criticism of Donald Trump on the refugee and Islamic immigration issues. And then there's the farther right conservative evangelical movement, including people that belong to fundamentalist Bible churches, some charismatics and Pentecostals. But in Iowa, that's represented by groups like the Family Leader, nationally by groups like the Family Research Council. And I think Iowa is a little bit further to the right in terms of its evangelical ethos than the nation. And so that farther right conservative group is larger in Iowa than it is in the rest of the country. And most of the Iowa activists in conservative activists in Republican politics come from that wing.
When you talk about the various factions among evangelicals here in Iowa and nationally, is Cruz someone who can lasso all of those together best?
I think he can bring together most of those groups. As you mentioned last time, Santorum, the endorsements for Santorum came only a couple weeks before the actual caucuses. And so he wasn't able to build the momentum. I think what they're able to do right here is put some very strong pressure on the other conservative Christian candidates in the race, like Huckabee and Santorum, and even pull away some of the Ben Carson supporters as he declines. And in addition, I think the other advantage for Cruz is he's been speaking strongly on issues like immigration and some of the issues with foreign policy that have come up recently. And so he's trying to position himself as being the beneficiary not just of the decline of someone like Carson, but also what he sees as the eventual fall of someone like Trump.
So the other ones in his category, Santorum and Huckabee, also vying for the Christian evangelical vote here in Iowa, they're polling very poorly in the past few weeks. So would you see them continuing on?
I think most of them are going to stick it out at least till the caucus date. But beyond that, I'm not sure that they would have the resources to go on. And that's what we've seen in previous races is people just don't have the funding to continue with a national campaign that you have to start to wage every week, week after week, with multiple primaries after Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina.
Specifically, what issues matter most to evangelical Christians in Iowa and the nation?
Well, I think the religious liberty issue is one that I've pointed to in the last few weeks as one that I think Cruz was well positioned to take advantage of. It's an issue of large concern, particularly with people like Bob Vanderplaats and conservative Christians in Iowa. There's a feeling that the tide has turned against them, and with the legalization of gay marriage in Iowa and now across the country, that they're really fighting an uphill battle culturally. And so I think Cruz is one of the best positioned to take advantage of that. He's spoken a lot about religious liberty. He's actually made it the focus of many of his events. And I think what Cruz has been able to do is find a defining issue. And I see some of these other candidates, whether conservative Christian or more to the moderate wing, having trouble really defining what is the one issue that sets them apart from the others. And so I think Cruz has done the best job doing that, particularly in a way that will appeal to the concerns of Iowa evangelicals.
And that defining issue is very important, Kedron, because it's all about igniting the base, making sure they do not stay home.
Particularly when you have this many candidates, I think you have to find something that absolutely sets you apart as distinctive from the others. And I think he's done the best job of doing that.
Is the evangelical vote in Iowa playing as big a role in this election cycle as it has in previous years?
I think it has continued to grow. If you look at some of the exit polls from the last few elections, the share of the evangelical vote, born-again Christian vote, in the Iowa caucus entrance and exit polls has continued to get larger, and it was over 50% in the last caucus. I think that could be diluted somewhat this time because you may get some new voters out coming out for Trump who are maybe some disaffected voters who haven't participated in past caucuses. But Trump is kind of a separate problem that I think some of these candidates can't be worrying about. Right now what they need to do is win their lane, you know, whether that's the conservative Christian lane or the mainstream Republican lane. And then, you know, if Trump's still there in March, they can worry about it then.
Some have criticized the Iowa caucuses as being very heavily skewed towards the evangelical vote, heavier than in the rest of the country. What does it say about the relevance of the Iowa caucuses?
Well, I think that the Iowa caucus is still absolutely relevant. As I said, the evangelical vote is not monolithic. Even with the endorsement of Santorum late last time, he only got 33% of the evangelical vote. So that means two-thirds of the vote from evangelicals went to these other candidates. So there is still room to represent and say that you represent to the national stage the various factions or varieties of Republicanism that exist. And I think it's Iowa in conjunction with the other states, New Hampshire with more independence, more focus on fiscal issues, and then Nevada bringing in a little bit more ethnic diversity with a large number of Hispanics. I think it's the constellation of those primaries and caucuses that create the system that we think provides a pretty good process for weeding out and winnowing out candidates as we get closer to a nominee.
Kedron, I just saw a Fox Business headline, business news headline that asks, is Ted Cruz Trump light? What do you say to that?
I think in a number of ways he is. He's not as brash in some of the rhetoric that he uses, but I know there's been a number of articles looking at specific issues that say that Cruz and some of the other Republicans actually aren't that far from Trump. But I think, you know, in the end, Trump, again, I think he's going to rise or fall on his own weight and by his own mouth. And, you know, Cruz needs to be worried about Cruz and wrapping up the conservative evangelical vote and also appealing where he can to the issues that Trump voters are concerned about, which I think right now is immigration and then the foreign policy questions related to ISIS.
In this endorsement, Bob Vanderplaats of Family Leader acknowledged that Cruz is not the most popular senator among his colleagues, but he sees him as competent. What is it about Cruz that makes him less popular among his colleagues, senators and other congressmen, and congressmen in the House, for instance?
Yeah, I'd pick that out, too, as probably the most interesting thing that Vanderplaats said. Not always popular, but very competent. And I think there's probably two angles that I think strategically are the campaigns and their Cruz supporters are working there. Number one, they're kind of playing off the idea of the celebrity of Trump and okay, well, I'm not always popular, but I'm the one that you could count on. So I think that's one of the things that's going on is they're trying to address that kind of celebrity angle to the campaign that's come from some of these outsiders. But at the same time, they're trying to say, look, he's Trust Ted, if you look at his campaign slogan. That's what it is. It's Trusted, Trust Ted. And so they want someone who's a consistent conservative, and that's not going to be always someone that's the most likable candidate. I think Cruz has done a good job poking fun at himself a little bit on the campaign trail at some of these events recently, letting his guard down a little more and owning that you know, he may not be seen as the most flashy candidate or the most likable, but he's someone you can trust to be a consistent conservative. And that's the angle they're working, and I think it's working for them so far.
Fascinating insights from Kedron Bardwell, Associate Professor of Political Science and Department Chair at Simpson College in Indianola. Kedron, always wonderful to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. And finally, the story of 18-year-old Zachary Hoagland, who lives in Davis County. Davis County, right on Iowa's southern border with Missouri. It was back in October that Zach won the district cross-country meet, making him the first student to win a district title for his high school, Davis County High School. However, his win was taken away from him for a reason that has over 100,000 people upset enough to sign a petition. Zach was stripped of his title after helping another student during the race, aiding another student who he says appeared to be struggling across the finish line. Kelly Hall, who lives in Ohio, heard about Zach's story, and she started a change.org petition seeking to reinstate his title. He joins me now, Zach Hoagland. Welcome.
How are we doing today?
I'm doing fine. The question is how you are doing. Take us back to October. I guess it's October 22nd. Tell us what happened during that race, particularly at the end. You were first. You were the winner.
So I just got done finishing, and I was very happy, almost in tears of joy. And one of my, the parents of one of my teammates was there, and they were talking to me and, you know, and just unbelievable, thought it was amazing about how good I did.
Mm-hmm. And how long was the race?
The race was a 5K.
Okay.
Or 3.1 miles.
Mm-hmm. And so you finish, you're number one, you are the first district champion from Davis County High School. Then what happened?
I was walking back over to my teammates. Actually, I was talking to my coach, and she was very, very proud of me. And then I look back forward, and then I see this runner there that is, like a tell that he fell. He is holding his stomach, and he had mud on his knees, and I could tell that he wasn't doing so hot, so I thought I better help him. Before I went in there, though, I asked around, is anyone going to help him? But no one did, so then I went in there and helped him out.
Mm-hmm. So you helped him. How close was he to the finish line?
I'd say that he was about 25 meters from the finish line.
And he had fallen, he was injured, and he was, you said, holding his stomach and looking like he might not make it to the finish line?
Yeah, and I thought, after I talked to him, he said that he probably wouldn't have been able to finish if, someone would have been there. He would have been crawling anyway. So then my first reaction to seeing him look like this was, I better help him out. So I gave him an arm, and I helped him until he had 6 meters left to go. And I just kind of let him finish it.
Mm. Okay. So he finishes. You go back to maybe your team. Your mother was there, I believe, mm-hmm. too. And then what happened?
I just kind of helped cheer on the rest of my team. And I went, like you said, I went back to camp. And everyone was pretty happy. The boys' team did outstanding that day. The girls' team, as well, did really good that day. And everyone was giving each other high fives. And then after a while, I didn't see either one of my coaches around anywhere. So I asked, I was like, where's Coach Husted at? And they just said, well, he's been in the clubhouse for a little while. I was like, well, that's strange. Like, anyone know why? He's like, well, I guess he's probably going over the scores. I'm like, that's really strange. So after that, I asked, where's Tammy Roberts at, which is our assistant coach? And they said she's in the clubhouse too. So then I started really wondering what was going on. And then about 20 minutes after that, we started heading down to the scoreboard place, to see what the scores were. and get our awards. And then I talked to one of my buddies talked to me about a kid that did a similar act to even his own teammate last year. So that right there was kind of the red flag, maybe that I might be disqualified.
Mm-hmm. And when did you officially find out? Was it on the scoreboard that you were DQ'd?
No, actually it wasn't. It was actually my coach. I noticed that he walked out, and he was very emotional about it. And I just knew right then that, you know.
What did he say exactly?
I probably was. He just came up to me and he said, "I'm sorry about what happened." And then he gave me a hug. And he said, and he's like, "Well, I wish I could change it." He's like, "I wish there were some things that could change." And then I just said, "I need a few minutes." And I just kind of walked away on my own because I didn't want anyone to see me get emotional about it.
Mm-hmm. And what were your thoughts? What were your feelings at that moment?
At that particular moment, my feelings were, all that work, not really nothing, but, all that work for, pretty close to nothing, really. And I was pretty devastated, and
I can imagine.
Yeah.
And this is also the runner you helped. I understand that runner's mother came up to you afterwards to thank you after the race.
Yeah, about right after I helped him, she's like, "Thank you so much for helping my son. That was very kind of you."
The Iowa High School Athletic Association said that stripping your title from you was not an easy decision, but they emphasized that it won't be reinstated. Here's a bit of the statement they made hours after the disqualification. An athlete who receives or gives assistance to another runner in the same race is disqualified. While it was a sportsmanlike act to help someone in distress, it remained a violation, and the official had no choice but to enforce the rule. There was a petition started, as I mentioned. Kelly Hall lives in Ohio, heard about your story, and she started a petition. Tell us about that.
I didn't actually know about it until recently. One of my teachers told me a little bit about it, and that's actually how I myself found out. She said that someone from Texas signed it, so that's kind of how I found out. I thought it was just 100% amazing that she did that, because she's not even from even my own state. And
right.
I just thought that was just phenomenal that she did that.
This petition has a national following. In the meantime, the article that I read about it, which is several days old, has over 110,000 signatures on it. Part of the petition reads, "The Iowa High School Athletic Association claims it was only following the national rule that states you can't assist another runner. But that rule exists to prevent competitors from cheating, which Zach certainly was not doing in this case. When a rule is used to punish an act of human decency, you undermine the very sportsmanship you are trying to protect. Good works should be rewarded, not punished." So there you have the two sides of it, Zach.
Yeah, I think rules are rules, but then again, I feel like some of them could be changed. And I just hope that, they might take into consideration of, maybe reinstating it a little bit or, tweaking it a little bit. But mm-hmm. If they don't, at least more people know what sports is all about. Obviously you want to win and everything, but sometimes just by giving doing something simple as caring can really change the entire sport and how people view it.
I think you're absolutely right, Zach. I think you did something that makes us Iowans even prouder of you than winning that championship.
I'm just trying to do it. I figured anyone from Iowa would do, and I would just, try to do the right thing. Sometimes you don't always get the luck that you wanted with trying to do the right thing, but as one of my coaches said, you try and you fail, you try and you fail, but what really comes down to is the fact in which that what you're trying to do is right. Mm-hmm. I thought that was pretty good. Well, something that he told me.
That sounds like those are good words. Any hints at all that the High School Athletic Association will reinstate your win? Or perhaps allow two winners for this race? Why not?
At this point, I haven't really, to tell you the truth, I'd rather have the story than the medal by any means. But if they would do that, I think I'd just be, 100% awesome and unbelievable, to tell you the truth, if they would do that. And I hope that if they would do that, they would consider, emailing or you know, sending out mail or something to the people that this has happened to in the past, which I think is one thing that's just kind of preventing them from changing it. They'd feel probably pretty bad if they would do this now, because I'm sure it's happened so many times mm-hmm. prior to this, and they probably don't really see it as being fair.
Mm-hmm. All right, Zach, thank you for telling us your story. Certainly no something problem. That many of us will remember for a long time. You will remember it for a lifetime, you and your family. We'll watch this petition. We'll put a link to it, perhaps, when we post this story on our website. Zach Hoagland, a high school student at Davis County High School in southern Iowa, who was disqualified after winning the district title in cross country for Davis County High School after he helped another student during the race who was struggling, aiding another student shortly before the finish line. Zach, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And that's it for today. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.